Kia ora tātou, one and all. Good to see you here on such a lousy day. It's also good to see a pretty reasonable crowd come out on such a lousy day. I think most of you know me, Joe Hollander. I'm chair of the Palmer's North Defence Heritage Advisory Group and the Engineer Charitable Trust, who, along with Palmer's North City Library, co-host these events. Today we're commemorating the 70th anniversary of the Korean War Armistice. You may recall 3 years ago, Ian McGibbon did a presentation at the Globe Theatre, an evening presentation, where we commemorated the 70th anniversary of the start of the Korean War. Before we kick off, I just want to introduce one of our Korean vets, Tony Smith, up the front here. Our worshipful mayor's father. Some of our other Korean vets that we hope would be here today, Alan Cull, who's 99. Alan decided that he was going to a dental association luncheon, yes. I think, and Cliff Parker, whom some of you might know, unfortunately had a doctor's appointment. But anyway, there's some other display material here which I'm sure our speaker will explain shortly. So without further ado, I would like to introduce you to our speaker today, Colonel Retired Don Jones. Very important that he is a sapper, in other words, a military engineer. Also, Don is a trustee of the Engineer Charitable Trust, so it gives him full speaking rights today. And eventually he'll be taking over from me as chair of the Trust Board, which is even better news. But anyway, we'll worry about that later. So please welcome Don Jones.
Nice words, Joe. Thank you very much. I'm sure the whole audience know that you won't retire easily. And we thank you for your immense energy and service for that, the Trust and other organisations. But yeah, kia ora tātou, as I say in Korea, annyeong haseyo. It's great to be here. It's good to see so many faces and people I've seen before or know, as well as people I don't. So the 70th anniversary of the war, they call it the Forgotten War, and it came really on the end of World War II, which is of course unforgettable, and then a lot of people felt it was shattered by the Vietnam War. The way that some people were treated or neglected was one other reason, and I just sort of read recently that it took until 1989 before the names of the Roll of Honour was inscribed in the Auckland War Memorial Museum, but I'm not certain about that, that's what I heard. So, however, you know, it was a really extremely important war. It was had far more casualties and fatalities than the Vietnam War. Not that it's a contest, but you know, it was the third after World War One and Two in terms of the toll in World War in the 20th century, and you know. Over 3 million people killed, and you know, millions more injured. It was important too for step for New Zealand for foreign policy, and really how we got into ANZUS, and how we sort of evolved, but continued our sort of evolution and as part of the Commonwealth. But we'll get through some of that, but please, if you have any questions, there'll be time at the end for questions, but if you've got any questions, or just please sing out if you think of something or want to say something, and particularly for any people who've actually been in Korea or been in the war, I'm going to shut up, I think, at certain places and let you speak so I can understand what it was like, and there's a couple of questions I have got here, which and I'm pleased to also welcome my wife, Kareen. Kareen was with me up in Korea for my last 2 years there, so she knows a lot of these places. I went around biking a lot of there's lots of trails around around the DMZ and all those places now, which we've explored. But anyway, here we go. So that's what I'm hoping to cover today. A little bit of history, and how the Japanese annexed it. Talk about a bit about World War II, some issues that was affecting the country just before the war, and then talk about the phases of the war. It was extremely dynamic in the first year of the war, and the tide of the war swung incredibly. And we'll look at that. We'll talk about the armistice and then New Zealand's contribution to the war. Talk a little bit about some of the veterans' revisits to Korea, and then about New Zealand Defence Force's current contribution to Korea. We've got 12 people over there from NZDF at the moment, working for United Nations Command. And then, as I say, discussions and questions. So a bit about the background history. Way back, there was the what we call the Three Kingdoms. From sort of BC till about 8th century, there's Baekje down in the southeast, southwest, where the Scout Jamboree is at the moment. It's been flooded out. And Shilla Kingdom, and then Goryeo in the north, which is where they get the name Kor Korea was derived from. Then you've got this Chosen Dynasty for about 6 or 7 centuries that sort of a Confucian-based China sort of leaning kingdom that controlled Korea and had a number of successes, such as King Sejong is probably the most famous ruler who invented the alphabet, the Hangul alphabet, the symbols and all that sort of stuff. They had been speaking, Chinese variations before then, but they had their own language and have made their own language. It's quite incredible. And they were invaded numerous times by Japan. There was a number of amazing sort of sea battles by a guy called Admiral Yi, something called Li. And there were some invasions from China and Manchuria at the time as well. So they managed to keep their amazingly homogenous society with the language all through the peninsula, and they expanded a bit into Manchuria, but it's a kind of a, if you know it, it's a kind of a poor country. It's never been particularly rich, and it's been a sort of a rocky, hilly country, and very feudal, and it maintained its sort of isolationist policies right up until the late 19th century. In fact, they were so sort of resistant to outside rule and influences that there's a famous massacre in Seoul of the Catholics. There was some Christian missionaries were coming in, and they killed a lot of Catholics and drove them off the hill. It was only about 1870, so it was quite late. We went to the sort of modern church there now, and of course the Korea is very Christian at the moment since the war. Buddhist and Christian. One of the key events that really changed the future was opening up in the late 19th century, then the Russo-Japanese War, 1904-05, and where Japan came in and used Korea as a base, and really that was the beginning of the end, and stayed there, and then they officially annexed Korea in 1910. The map kind of shows it is the 20th century for Japan, really. You can see Japan in the red and the pink. You can see Korea down the bottom to the left there. And Japan expands into Korea, into Manchuria, and then into China, and wreaking havoc through all of those places, really, particularly lots of massacres in China. And then you're probably more familiar with the expansion into Southeast Asia, and of course Singapore, Indonesia, and Philippines, where they were in World War II. So that's kind of where the background for that is. So they were not, you can see that the, Korea is basically almost feudal, medieval feudal type society compared to like modern expansionist industrial Japan, who were far more outward looking. And it really contrasted. So the Japanese certainly looked down on the Koreans and thought they were just basic sort of backward type of people. Righto. So in World War II, you know the story, there was a lot of fighting up through the islands, and then, of course, the atom bomb at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Before then, it was... it was the inevitability of the end of Japan's empire was becoming evident to a lot of people, and they knew they had to collect the signatories, the surrender signatories from all the Japanese in Korea. And there was a plan, not really a high-level plan, actually. I understand it was like two colonels from the US who proposed to the Russians, well, what say we use, we'll collect the signatures from the south, you do it in the north, and maybe we just use the 38th parallel as a sort of a dividing line. And they went, yeah, that's pretty good. So they went around, that's how they basically collected the surrenders at the time. And that 38th parallel line became, with more occupation by the Soviets and by the US in the south, that became this de facto border. There was a trustee, UN trusteeship set up, but it didn't really work very well. That they planned that Korea should be one whole nation again, and that it should be there'll be elections. But in the end, only the South had the elections. The North, when the Soviets came in, they brought with them a whole lot of Soviet-trained Korean guerrillas and other people who basically set up pretty quickly a communist-style government in the north. And in the south, the US was a guy called Syngman Rhee, who was the first president. He came in, he was a very anti-communist lobbyist from the US. There was a whole lot of division inside South Korea, though. There was sort of communist sympathizers, a whole lot of other people, other nationalists, people who didn't particularly like the US. Anyway, there was such a lot of division that there was conflict at time, and probably the worst one was the Jeju uprisings and massacres by the government of the people of Jeju. Jeju is the sort of the island down the bottom. Yeah, it's sort of a volcanic island. It's a bit different to the rest of Korea. It's a bit warmer, grows citrus fruit and all that sort of thing. But anyway, people are slightly different to the rest of Korea, but... anyway, they had a number of uprisings and massacres, so a pretty sad time. What you can see in this particular photo, let's see if I can go around. Has this got a, I'm not sure if it's got a light on. No. I'll talk over here. You've got, obviously, the 38th parallel. You see this blue land down here is the Kaesong Plains, and it's probably the best fertile rice-growing area in the whole of Korea. It's particularly good. Kaesong Heights. Kaesong was a previous capital in one of the former kingdoms. You can see the Imjin River comes into... This is the Han River here, and there's a North Han River that goes up through to Kaepyeong. And this is the Imjin River. It sort of starts, it goes sort of west-east pretty much along the DMZ or the 38th parallel for a while. Then it branches up north and it flows into the Han River estuary. So these are all, there's Incheon. We'll talk about that later with the Incheon landings and some other famous things. Taegu, often spelled, now spelled with a D, and Busan, now spelled with a B, Busan. But anyway, so as you'll see, this is kind of where the border finishes 3 years later after the war finishes, but it's slightly different, and we'll see how that goes. The north is more secure. It's also better trained militarily. It's more stable. And the north elect a guerrilla leader who had been famous in opposing the Japanese, Kim Il-sung, and he was like the first, he not immediately, but became, through all the various communist bureaucracy secretaries and all that sort of thing, became the leader. He decides, they got a lot of backing from the Soviets, he decides that he wants to try and unify the peninsula under sort of a communist administration. He writes to Stalin, he writes to Mao, and he gets their endorsement. And Stalin is quite keen on this and has a bit to do throughout the conflict, but he doesn't give anything in writing. Mao is still keen to... he's still busy really with his own struggles at that time, and was basically keen to, you know, get the goodwill of the Soviets. Basically endorses it. The apparent endorsement from the Chinese means that they'll provide troops if need be if the situation gets pretty bad. Anyway, so it's a sort of a powder keg of stuff going on in South Korea at the time, and US, who are also war weary after World War II, are kind of happy to leave. They leave behind a Korean training force. I think it's the, if I've got it written there, it's the Korean Military Advisory Group, I think they call it. Right, then 25th of June. 25th of June is what the Koreans often call it. They call it the equivalent of 25-6 or the conflict of 625 or whatever they sort of say. And these maps are pretty good, but you'll see that what says the 38th parallel there is not the 38th parallel. That's actually the DMZ. The 38th parallel is obviously parallel. It goes straight across. But anyway, that's just imagine. That's the only fault with these maps, because they're pretty good. I like the way they describe. Anyway, so they invade on a Saturday night. They think, oh, the Americans have got support, are going to be entertaining themselves, and they probably were, and so early morning Sunday they start to react, and it's too late. And they basically caught unawares. There's a bit of intelligence saying that CIA had seen some movement, but thought it was just being a sort of a defensive posture by the North, because the South had also, and the Soviets had a lot of advantage. What was one of the, I'm sure there's a lot of Korean War experts here, what did the North Koreans have that the South didn't in terms of military capabilities? They had tanks, nice one. They had T-34 tanks, and they were pretty good. They had about two or three hundred of them, and there were none at all with the Americans or the Koreans in the South, and they were pretty lethal. I think T-34s are probably one of the best tanks in World War II. It was before they had main battle tanks, which was really after World War II, and I think they'd probably call it a medium tank these days, or part of World War II, but they were easy to operate, and these ones have been upgraded from, I think, a 76 mil gun to like an 85 mil gun, and were pretty unstoppable. And I've put the photo of this guy, General Pike Sung-yup. He was a divisional commander at the age of 28, which is so like a major general, which is pretty surprising. And he was the first Korean to become made a four-star general. After the war, he went on to become like their ambassador to France, I think, and a couple of other countries, as well as holding some ministerial positions. But anyway, he's an incredible guy. I've read his memoirs, and I went to his... I was like the New Zealand representative at his funeral, because the ambassador couldn't go down in Daejeon, the National Cemetery in Daejeon. Anyway, so in Seoul, he was in Seoul attending a course at the School of Infantry or something when they got the news. So he rushed back up. So he was in charge. He was the commander of 1 Div, which is right up at Munsan near Panmunjom, right near the DMZ that it is now. So he rushes up there and his staff car and takes control of stuff. But he said it was just chaos. He said they were getting smashed and smashed. 3 days later, they found themselves on the wrong side of the Han River going, what the hell's happened? And he realised he was still wearing his office uniform from his course, you know, like short sleeve and slacks and shoes, and they hadn't had time to get changed. He said he had no sleep in those 3 days. he said the tanks were insane. He said that his troops were, a lot of them were doing suicide sort of rushes onto them with bundles of explosives to try and stop them, but they couldn't. They were just too organised, and they went to the, there was some more resistance south of the Han River, which is quite a wide river. For the, all the sappers, they did a reserve demolition on the river, on the bridge, the Hungang Bridge, while there were still plenty of civilians crossing it, and they just, and then there were still forces trapped on the other side, so it's not doctrinally how you do reserve demolitions at all, so, but they just wanted to stop the North so badly that they just did it, you know, as soon as they were ready, so killed a lot of their own people. Anyway, by that stage, they're joined, the US reacts, and they send a force over from Japan, I think it's from the 24th Infantry Division, called Task Force Smith, named after the CO, like Lieutenant Colonel Smith, and they get up to Osan, and Task Force Smith, there are only about 500 people, it's basically got the battalion, and you know, I think North Korea invaded with something like 70,000 troops, so they get pretty badly beaten. They they're not particularly experienced soldiers. The officers have been in World War II, a lot of them, and they didn't have any anti armor. They had no tanks. They had some apparently 76 mil recoilless rifles that just had no effect on the T-34s. They had some bazookas. But apparently they had only had six heat rounds, high-explosive anti-tank rounds. So they worked, but well, a few of them worked. Anyway, they did sort of delaying defence all the way down, and I think we're lucky that the North Koreans, even though they had the numbers and the will and the tanks, didn't really have tactically savvy, so we just weren't conducting the battles particularly well. So, but anyway, they got down, right down to formed the perimeter of Pusan. There were British troops landing and more Americans landing, and they formed the Pusan perimeter around Daegu. And by this stage, General Paik, the guy in the picture, he gets back with whatever remnants as he could. As he fights a number of battles, and he gets his you know, about 20-30% of his division, or just stragglers, will join him, and they gradually build up. They paired with an American unit there, and he forms, and they basically, the Americans mainly and the Koreans, they form this perimeter of savage fighting. And, you know, North Korea almost do it. They come extremely close to getting the whole peninsula rapidly. So, but they hold on. And then what happens? Right. So as they're grinding to this meat grinder around the Pusan perimeter, you've got the sort of the Nakdong River there and some other mountain ranges, and North Koreans are charging through this area into through minefields and all that sort of stuff. The United Nations commander has one of his best ideas. Who was the commander? General? MacArthur. Yeah, MacArthur. Right. So he's not only a World War II veteran, he's a World War I veteran, so he's pretty old at that stage. And he comes up with the idea for the Incheon landings, or the staff do, and he pumps it. And so they have these landings at Incheon. Which you can see the arrow off to the west, and they come in with amphibious forces. I've been to the commemorations of the Incheon landings there. There's a small island where they have the commemorations. Now it's joined up to the port of Incheon by a small causeway. But all the west coast of Korea is sort of a lot of mud flats and quite a big tide, and it's quite treacherous for shipping coming in and out. So they decided that they're going to have to do like a preliminary op to secure this island, otherwise we'll jeopardise their whole landing. So they send a smaller group and seize this island, but there's only about a section of North Koreans on it, so they'll give up, and so they have a nervous wait while they wait for the cycles of the tides to come around, and they think, oh no, this has just alerted all of North Koreans to come and defend Incheon. But there was very few North Koreans over there. Eventually, some units from Seoul did come across, but by that stage, the main landings had occurred, and they got ashore, and I think with very few casualties, a massive force. And at that stage, including two of the New Zealand frigates were in support of that landing. That forces the whole North Koreans to basically go, you know, we've been outmaneuvered, enveloped to the rear, and they start to this massive withdrawal that turns into a rout, and the UN forces start moving up from Busan perimeter and cleaning up, basically. There's a lot of discussion about that the North Koreans have almost culminated at the perimeter, and so they were going to culminate anyway, and this was just the last straw. Anyway, whatever happens, they get into Seoul, they retake Seoul, they get back to the 38th parallel. A lot of the UN forces, even the US, thinking, well, we've taken back the country now what? I feel like Syng Man Rhee, and the Koreans go, right, we want our country back, now's the time. So they start going north, and about a week later, the US join them, and they take Pyongyang, and they get right up to, there's more, the same outfit that does the Incheon landings, which was 10 Corps, or was it Kang X Corps, the Roman numerals, 10, do this landing up at Wonsan. By that stage, the ground troops had got there anyway. Wonsan's on the east coast up there. And they get right up to the Yalu River. Yalu River is the border between China and North Korea. And everything's, well, that's great. And people say, oh, we're going to be home for Christmas. But Chinese have other ideas. So the Chinese at this stage join in. At this stage, it had been North Koreans fighting. Now there's Chinese fighting. And General Pak, who we mentioned before, in his memoirs, he's now up. He's one of the divisions that take Pyongyang. He's now right up the top. And they come across, his troops start getting these other soldiers who you can tell are Chinese. They're wearing different uniforms. He tells the US that, oh, these Chinese are in here. And they, for a good day or two, the US don't believe them, saying, oh, they're just other types of North Koreans. So they go, you know, Koreans know they're not Koreans because they're not speaking Korean, they're speaking Chinese. And he goes, there's a lot of people over here. And eventually, what had happened is Chinese had strategically infiltrated about 200,000 troops, just basically going through the hills on foot, and gone right up into the north of Korea, moving at night. And every time they saw a plane, they'd stop. And quite incredible, they got in basically there without anyone knowing it, and they started to attack. So there was sort of ambushes at sort of brigade level where, you know, there was, you know, caught everyone by surprise. And the UN forces were pretty weak by that stage. There was a lot of fighting. They were down to reductions of poor ammunition and all that sort of stuff. And we're starting to get fought back. The Chinese had high morale and you know, equipment, no casualties, so they started pushing in. On the map on the sort of easter, you'll see the Chosin Reservoir. There's a sort of a story in itself there. The US Marines had a big moment in their history where they have a massive defeat, basically. They're kept there for about 10 or 12 days. In the winter, it's bitterly cold. I recall going when I first got to my post in Seoul. It was January, and oh, it was bloody cold here. And I took my uniform and a puffer jacket. My ears were cold. It was minus 16 for about a whole week. So you think sort of why it is cold, or today, think again. So I mean, it was largely sort of dry, sunny weather. It's pretty arid winter, but. up there was even worse, and a lot of the Marines died, just were frozen to death and couldn't operate. They do this evacuation to Hung Nam, it's a port there, and there's a famous evacuation, like the amazing humanitarian evacuation. There's a freighter, I'm not sure if it's a Norwegian ship or something like that, but it can hold about a few hundred people. They fit in like 10,000 North Korean, you know, refugees, including the parents of President Moon, who's just finished being president, and President Moon's, they at that stage come down to the south. That's how they get down to the south. The Chinese with the North Koreans then take Seoul and get back down to Osei. So when they took Seoul, they massacred basically all of the people who had been in the administration from the previous time, basically not taking any prisoners. And you get the situation where, you know, it's the whole thing swung again. But then you've got phase four, which is basically to push north again. By this stage, we've got 16th Field Regiment here. So they've landed at Busan on New Year's Eve, I think it was, and have gone and have probably missed the action. Some of them will be feeling happy about that. Some of them will be feeling sad about that, I guess. I think they're all feeling... We know that they were all feeling cold because they had the summer uniforms and it was winter. So, anyway, they join in this part and take part of this counter-offensive and go north past the 38th parallel into the... and are in positions at the start of April where there's a massive Chinese spring offensive where you get basically China to build up and they force down a number of areas, including down the Kapiol Valley where the Commonwealth Brigade was and 16th Field Regiment. And we'll talk about the Battle of Kapiol later on, but that's where that takes part. So they have that sort of period. So some people say that's like the fourth phase or the end of the phases, but there's a fifth phase. Really, it's 2 years of attritional warfare. If you can think of the Somme, but with hills and mountains and freezing winters and stinking hot summers, then it's kind of like that. And people say not much happened there. Well, that's incorrect. It's sort of intense fighting all the way through. So you get some, you know, horrific battles like Heartbreak Ridge and Bloody Ridge, the Hook, Porkchop Hills, a number of sort of famous battles of the Iron Triangle, where you've got horrific sort of fighting going on. So I put the picture of MASH in there. That MASH was my first awareness of the Korean War, and it is for a lot of people, I think. MASH was the Mobile Surgical Hospital. Was based in, does anyone know what town they're based in, fictionally in the book? So I know Kree knows because she biked there, so please. Okay, Wijongbu, it's just a bit north of Seoul on the number one subway line, and it's the main route into Seoul. And on that line, still to this day, there's Camp Casey, where the US, most of the US have now withdrawn out of the dozens of camps they have into a massive super camp called Camp Humphreys, sort of south of near Osun on that map. But Camp Casey is still where the MASH unit was at Wijongbu, in one of the direct approaches. That's where they've got their Abrams tanks based. So even though their Korean armour K2 tanks are incredibly good and they've got a lot of massive force, they still like to have the American tanks right up in that little spot in case there's something that comes down. So they've got, because Korea and US have got an alliance since the 1970s, so, and politically most of the Koreans are very supportive of the Americans still being there. Anyway, so in that period, so Wijongbu, just where the MASH unit was, is right up in there. It's sort of based on a similar, it's based on a historical mesh unit, but also with a lot of hijinks thrown in. And it was kind of smaller than the usual size that they had. I think it was like 4 surgeons in the story, but it was actually about 12 in a typical mesh. I had the pleasure of going to a Norwegian mesh commemoration activity, and they called that NORMASH, but that wasn't one of the ones that was there. So there were 16 states that supported the South, 16 combat-sending states, including New Zealand, with another 4 or 5 others who gave medical support, including Norway, Denmark, Sweden, Italy, India, and they had a lot of these countries had their own MASH units and provide support to the war as well as to the locals. So the fighting continued, and right up until the 27th of July, and again, just amazing bloody fighting. I went to the interment of Bill Speakman. He was a UK Victoria Cross winner. He had his ashes interred at the UN Cemetery in Busan. I was lucky enough to be the DA at the time, so I went down to see that. He was a sort of a very larger-than-life Scotsman who liked to drink and was fearless in battle, and he did a bit of it like a Charles Upham. I think he went down to a point of a bag of grenades and saw off attack after attack of Chinese coming in. And I've also read the account of the actor Michael Caine. He was a very young 18-year-old when he went off to war there, and he writes in his memoirs that how terrified he was. He'd only been in, like, there for a day or two, assumed his position. I think he was a private with the Fusiliers. And he just said that the Chinese were so scared in the middle of the night. There's flares, there's trumpets, there's bang on drums, and they started attacking. And he said they were crazily brave. They were running across minefields into their position. He was just shooting and shooting and shooting for days. And he said he's never been so terrified in all his life. So I think it was interesting to get people like that spend their time there. And then there's the armistice being signed. That's probably the best picture of it. There's you've got the US on the left of the picture, General Harrison, signing on the left, and on the right we've got General Nam from the Chinese People Volunteers. But it was also signed later on by General Clark, who by that stage was head of the UN. He was the commander of the UNC. General Clark, we're probably known to the Kiwis by that stage because he'd been where? In their military history? Italy, yeah. He was a commander. He was Freiburg's commander in Italy when they bombed Monte Cassino. So here he is, here again as the commander. He signs this. Not here. So they didn't sign it at the same places even. So this was one signing where they were together. But I think Kim Il-sung signs it up in Kaesong. Initially the talks were in Kaesong, but they moved it back to Panmunjom. And it's also signed by the head of the Chinese, Peng Duai, was the Chinese volunteer army. So you've got three countries who sign it. You've got China, you've got North Korea, you've got the US, or representing the UN. And the South Koreans don't want to sign it. Syngman Rhee was annoyed that they're doing an armistice because he wants to take over the whole country. But also they think, if we sign this, by having the US sign it, they'll be obliged to come back and finish it. Because, as we know, it's an armistice. It's not a peace treaty, it was just a temporary agreement really amongst the generals at the time. And the talks had been going on. They started 10th of July 1951, so now 2 years later they finally actually signed it. So when people talk about, there's no point about signing talking, it takes time. So people talk about other agreements, like, you know, when they talked about that with, you know, the Taliban talks, you know, oh, it's never going to happen. Well, people like that talk for a long time, but that spring offensive that Caleb Gatjong and the Kiwis helped to blunt really made the Chinese, apparently the strategic Chinese, think, and Stalin and others, think that, you know, that victory is not going to be possible. So they signed that, and you were there at the end of the war, so you probably know this better than me, but around about this, at this stage, 16 field regiment were up near the Imjin River when the armistice is signed, and there's apparently a lot of enthusiasm. They stay, they occupy this site, the Imjin, and you can see the Kiwi Hill there, that they make this, and the Imjin River's in the background, and the chapel, I think it's called St. Bridget's. St. Barbara, sorry, yeah, of course it would be, yeah. And so were you there at the time when you occupied this?
No, a bit later.
A bit later?
Yeah. Alan Wilson was there. He said, Warren Oxford's in charge of it. Dracula.
Right.
He freshly built all the roads.
Right.
And everything. So it was hard going.
Yeah.
But with the march out of the 16th field, there's a photograph showing the man below it that was taken on the day of the march out of the 16th Corps.
Hmm.
The guns were parked along the bottom.
Right. So today, well, today, but now, we've been along there to try and find this. There's a camp, there's a Rock Army camp in the lowland, but on the hill there's no chapel, there's no Kiwi sign, it's just overgrown, there's a couple of houses up there. It's kind of hard to see. Was it? Yeah. So, according to my notes, 16 Field stayed there from the end of the war, approximately a year and a half, and then came back. Other units stayed from New Zealand, such as 10 Transport Company, and others.
We haven't done 9 months.
Right.
You went down to 10 companies.
Right.
If you complete your 18 months.
Oh, okay. A lot of the veterans I saw were from 10 Transport rather than the Gunners. They were just a bit younger, I think. In the
I finished up in Combs Platoon 10 Company.
Yeah, okay.
Feeding the Canadians.
Yeah, right.
So, because they didn't need British
ration. New Zealand's contribution to the war. So you've got these... On the outbreak of the war, you've got these three UN Security Council resolutions, and in the interest of time, I won't read them out, but basically, they one condemns the attack, the second one recommends member nations furnish assistance to South Korea, and the third one is to provide military support to South Korea under the leadership of the UN. And New Zealand is one of the first states to answer the call, and immediately sends up two... frigates, two lock-class frigates, the Pukaki and the Tutera. And eventually all six frigates, and I can't believe we had six frigates, but we've got like two now, would rotate through the Korean theatre. So it's incredible that there was... why did the Security Council resolutions pass? Does anyone know that? Yes?
Russians weren't there that day.
Yeah, so the Russians were there. They were apparently protesting the fact that China wasn't represented properly. They had Chiang Kai-shek, the Chinese nationalists who were in Taiwan, as the official representatives. And so they, of course, went, yep, we support that. The Russians didn't. And shortly later, the communist China takes its place instead of them. But so that's how it got through and got supported by the UN. So it wouldn't happen today. So the frigates are up there already. Then a bit later, there's a plea from the UN Secretary General, and they agree to form a 1,000-man group, and they said it's going to be artillery. There's a lot of discussion about why it was artillery and not a battalion. Apparently a lot of these decisions were made by the defence attachés in Australia, in Washington and London. They basically, they were keen, Australia were extremely keen to have like two infantry battalions, so were the Canadians and the British, and basically said, oh, why don't the Kiwis do the artillery? And this apparently sat well with the our Prime Minister Holland, and Holland apparently been a gunner in World War II, and they thought there'd be less casualties, which is completely true, particularly at the start of the war, because there wasn't much counter-battery fire. They form a Commonwealth Division, we send more people, the transport company, signalers, I remember chatting to people at Des Vinton, he was a signaler officer who read out the names of the honour guard at the recent commemoration at Giaho on the 27th of July, and talked about his job writing, dispatch writing in and around Seoul and stuff like that, and up to the lines. There weren't many sappers there. I don't know what we had there, maybe a section, yes, or so. Is that all? And I think they were lumped in with the UK British engineers.
George Butcher.
So he was a lovely guy. I remember him being sort of a mentor when I was a second lieutenant building the extension of the Army Museum in Wairu. And he got a military cross for a number of actions, I think. One was what I've read is he helped get a patrol, infantry patrol that was stuck in a minefield, and he led them out before daylight happened and before the North Koreans could start watering them. And also there was a story of where during flooding, the bridge was about to be washed away with a lot of log jams and stuff coming onto the bridge, and he climbed down off the bridge onto into the flooded river and onto the floating logs and set charges that would blow up the logs and protect the bridge. But anyway, Joe, have you got any sort of more comments about
that? Yeah, I think we had a troop of engineers who were around about 40-odd.
Okay.
I mean, but they were scattered around different elements. I mean, for example, Jerry Grieve was with the military police force. Of all things, for those of us who know Jerry Grieve, the most glorious engineer you can remember. And then we had a number of others who were working with the Canadians, but principally 22 Engineer Regiment UK was the parent engineer organisation, and I think we basically had a Kiwi troop under their command.
Okay.
Sabre Pittman.
Sorry?
BEN.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Yeah. That's another one.
He turned up three times.
Oh, okay. And that's the gun is, of course, firing a 25-pounder and also working in Seoul. That's the picture of the leaving the troop ship, leaving Wellington. But just a bit about the Battle of Kaepyeong. This was the 70th anniversary. I was speaking to, addressing that. The Koreans put up this massive video screen. This is at the Anzac Park. If you go to Korea, has anyone been to this park? Visited this park? It's a lovely sort of a day drive out of Seoul. There's some nice gardens around, and this is basically the battalion headquarters of 3RAR, where they had got this park. And down the end, I'm speaking on the, with also the lemon squeezer on, but down the end you can see the Kiwi memorial stone, and the audience are over there. It's normally packed, but because of COVID, and it was 21. April 21, so everyone's spaced out for COVID reasons. But the map shows the outlying area. Just to point out some of the stuff, you've got 3RAR, it's an infantry battalion, these are the companies, and it's a massive hill, the Delta Company, up there, high ground. We had a sort of a battlefield tour. It took us about an hour to climb up the hill from the road. You've got Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry on these sort of ranges over here. You've got the Middlesex Battalion at the back, 3RAR headquarters in here. But the space, this, I think, you know, I've passed all my courses at tech school in Wairu about placement of, defensive positions, and I think this would fail, because normally one of the rules is you have to have mutual support. You know, you're supposed to be able to fire across, and they're supposed to fire across. Well, this is too far. It's about 2 or 3 kilometres, and they had no sort of weapons that could do that. So our guns were particularly necessary for keeping off the forward slopes. Prior to this happening, there were 2 batteries of 16 field forward, I think supporting 6 rock division way forward, who were in contact with the Chinese. But the Chinese did their spring offensive. They smashed through the rock, and the New Zealand gunners up there, the first thing they knew there was a retreat, was basically when the Koreans started streaming through their lines. So they go, holy moly, and they were, you know, it's a chaos. They said they're carrying the cows, which were part of the kitchen units, and leading them along. And basically, they're narrow roads nowadays. It's so hilly. But back then, they were just mud tracks. And so the 2 batteries from 16 field came in. They came into about here and started support. There were 2 tank platoons of US tanks in support, Shermans, and they easily fought them back, but suddenly started to get overwhelmed and enveloped, and they pulled back. And the battle hats on to 3 RAR. We've had a number of casualties in there, including the Ford Observer artillery officers, the Chinese have a habit of basically going where you are to try, and the infiltration is amazing, and they get up these steep hills at night and started moving in. 16 field, these river valleys. So 16 field start getting them onto their position. You know, that's one thing you don't want. And, you know, normally the problem for gunners is you get counter battery fire, and that's but the Chinese didn't really have at this stage much indirect fire. So they moved back. I think they moved back behind the Middlesexes to get some protection. And they fight for about a day. You can see some of the tours nowadays, the positions as a sort of a walkway. They fight for about a day and a half, and then they withdraw. Well, not a victory, they certainly blunted. The Chinese seem to have culminated in the attack. They lost, I think, about potentially 20,000 people, soldiers attacking at that time. And brigade withdraw, but there's no follow-up, really. And that's happened across most of the front, and they don't. The Chinese attack with blunders. So that's that story. It happens like the 23rd, 24th of April, and then, of course, there's Anzac Day. That made sort of, for me, the biggest ceremonies of my job were sort of on that sort of week, and that's when we had the veterinary visits as well. So this is, there's at least, by these casualty figures, there's almost 3 million. I got those from the Encyclopedia Britannica, but I've read other sources that say there's 3 to 5 million. And you can see even there, there's, a million civilians from South Korea alone that died. We have the Americans have 36,000 killed, which is an incredible amount, really. We have 45 died. We'll just finish up, and 32 are still buried over there. We do veterans revisits. There's a great story of this guy, Happy October, who from Ten Transport Company, who I helped find this 38th parallel marker. He had a reenactment photo. This is him leaning on it. The Korean government are extremely grateful for all of the countries that help and fund approximately 6 veterans to come across every year, and their spouses. Pay for their flight, pay for the hotel, there's a whole week of activities. They tend to bring them over. The Commonwealth ones tend to come over in that week in April, because it's got the Battle of Kapgang, where all the Commonwealth countries are represented, and Anzac Day. We're taking them to Busan, and it's incredible support that they have. Nowadays, we've got 12 people over there, the 6 at Headquarters UN Command, who's now at Camp Humphreys, and the 6 at the Military Armistice Commission, 2 of which up at the DMZ. That's a group of the contingent there on with Ambassador Philip Turner, and that's the New Zealand Kafeong Memorial Stone behind them. It's on the top right picture there. That's some of them that could come across. One of them works at the Panmunjom in the Joint Security Area, where you can see those blue huts there. That's Conference Row, and that's a group of the sending state ambassadors, and they still have sending state ambassador conferences once a month that the UN commander, four-star, will brief the ambassadors from the 22 sending states about what's going on. And it's an incredible way that they get there. New Zealand, by their contribution there, has a lot of diplomatic clout, and they get a big intelligence brief, as well as you know, a lot of favour from the US and the Koreans for their involvement. This helicopter is a UH-60, a Black Hawk, and it's one of the times I was able to ride up from Yongsan Camp, which is inside Seoul these days, and to go up to the DMZ to, under the armistice agreement, we're allowed to land at certain landing zones inside the DMZ to do armistice verification. So once a month they'll pass the messages between the North Koreans, so we're going to fly into the DMZ. So they often take defence attaches or diplomats up, fly in that flight, and it's got the yellow bands to show it's not an armed one, it's part of the armistice verification. So when I'm up there, I had to wear this yellow band as well to show that I was observer. So we've still got people there, it's a good mission. But that's about it. Sorry, I've taken up a bit more time than I expected, but I've got a few little things here to see if you wanted to see. This is a good series of the phases. You're welcome to take these if you wanted to. But are there any questions or points that anyone would like to make?
What type of country was it? Was it an open country?
It was very, very rugged. It was very hilly. I guess it's reminds me a bit of like the lower North Island around the Rimutakas or the Rohinis. It's very, very rugged. They don't have super high mountains, but it's just a lot of ruggedness, and it's a lot of those are covered in forest now, but during the war they weren't. It's very quite arid. Dry really, apart from arid, dry, cold winters, and in winter, summer they have the sort of monsoon effect, so it gets quite warm, very hot, humid, and more rainfall. Yes?
I went to Incheon with the Navy in about 1962, and it was a very depressed, dirty, run-down place before the economic miracle.
Right.
And I could never figure out why they fought over the place.
Yeah.
It was terrible.
What ship was that with?
Otago. Taranaki.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it was one of the guys, there was a repatriation ceremony when I was there of two service people that were killed, and one of them was just from a ship that happened to be passing. He just got crook and he died in hospital in Incheon, and so he was buried in the cemetery, but nothing really to do with the war, but counted in that 45. And there was another sailor killed. I think one of the first sailors was killed was a guy who just fell off a frigate. He was tying up a sail on the ship, so he fell off on the voyage up, so that's just a terrible waste. And Marchione's the other guy who had some raiding parties that were trained up for the Royal Marines, and he'd gone in a raiding party. I think he's from Taihape originally. Gone in a raiding party, got shot up, and they're carrying his body back. They couldn't get back to the small boats to take him back to the frigate, so they left him on the shore dead, basically.
Frigates were involved too with shooting into North Korea up off the coast.
Yeah. They had the benefit and joy of basically maritime domination and air domination for most of it. So it was, they were very useful at providing flight support and raiding parties.
Any other questions?
Have you got any feeling personally about the near to medium future as to what might happen, or is it pretty dormant and neutral at the moment?
Yeah, I don't think I just can't see them ever going to be integrating and having reunification unless the system collapses in North Korea. I mean, you'll see that Kim Jong-un is stepping up rhetoric and testing. They'd stopped testing ballistic missiles the whole time I was there. And they started up again, and the intercontinental ballistic missiles. But yeah, there's rumors that they'll start up doing another nuclear test as well. They've almost certainly got nukes. But they're an extremely poor country, and you know, it's a savage regime where they live under some sort of a, you know, ideology where they are either brainwashed or pretending to be very brainwashed, because they know it's lethal if they don't sort of take the party line. But I've spoken to different people who've been up there, and it's just a horrible situation. Okay, for the elite living in Pyongyang, but out in the countryside, it's under sort of like a police rule, basically, where you're, and there's famines and starvation all the time.
All right. Well, look, it'd be probably better to call it a close there, because I think some people want to head off either back to work or whatever. So, look, would you join me, please, in thanking Don for his presentation?